Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Mona Cummings on the show. Mona is the CEO and director of Tree Fresno, a nonprofit organization working to increase our tree canopy in Fresno. In this conversation, we get into all things trees, but before that, we talk about Mona's fascinating and winding career in nonprofit work, international development work, and in the field of urban ecology. I know you'll enjoy this conversation. Let's go meet Mona, and Baker will take us there.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
Mona, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Where do I like to eat? I love Mexican food. I've always loved Los Panchos downtown. That's a favorite.
What's your order at Los Panchos?
At enchiladas.
Enchiladas.
Yeah, I'm an enchilada person.
A certain type?
Red, I like cheese enchiladas, and regular cheese enchiladas. And then when I go to Casa Corona, they have a green chili enchilada that I really like.
Didn't one of the Casa Coronas close recently?
Yes, but the one near me, Cedar and Herndon. Yeah, Cedar and Herndon, that's still it's still open.
Are you also an enchilada person at Casa Corona as well?
Yes, I am.
Which one's better if you had to choose? Los Panchos or Casa Corona?
Who's got the better enchilada? Los Panchos.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And they're so nice, that family that runs it. I've known them for years since I spent a lot of time down at the ballpark, and we used to walk across to Los Panchos.
It seems like it's like the hot lunch spot, or just right after work, go there and get a margarita before you go home or whatever. I've had a lot of fun evenings. I also remember Casa Corona does those kind of big, giant margarita bowl.
They do, and they have a really cute bar. They remodeled it, I think, a year ago.
Yeah.
And it's got very authentically Mexican flavor to it. You can take groups of people there. So I have a running group. We call it drinkers with a running problem. So the Hash House Harriers, and we go down there sometimes and have drinks together.
That's amazing. Obviously the focus of this conversation is going to be trees, but I wanted to ask you about your background a little bit, because there's so many fun things that you've done in your life that I just want to ask you about.
Sure.
So you served in the Peace Corps.
I did.
Something that I thought about doing but didn't follow through. Grad school lured me instead. But I often think regretfully that I didn't do it, because it seems like it's one of those things that you have a specific time in life where it could make sense for you to do before you start getting dependents, attachments, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And then you served in a really interesting place, small island off the coast of Africa. Mm-hmm. It's called Sao Tome and Principe.
Sao Tome e Principe.
Are those two different? Those are two different islands.
So correct? It's two islands that constitute one country. So it's a country of its own, and it's right on the equator on the west coast of Africa.
Okay.
So geographically, the armpit right out there off of Gabon.
Okay. And what most sticks with you from that time?
Oh, I was able to work in the tropical rainforest, and I worked in forestry. Okay. So that was my first position. I had graduated with a biology degree from Missouri State University and immediately joined the Peace Corps. And the day I graduated, the recruiter or the placement officer called me and asked me, do you want to serve in Gambia, where you would teach science, or do you want to serve in Sao Tome and Principe as a forestry volunteer? They have a really small program. And I said, I know where the Gambia is. I was like, where is Sao Tome? So this is the day I was graduating. My family was all there. And she said, it's this little island off in the middle of nowhere. And I'm like, that's exactly where I want to go. She said, do you want time to think about it? And I said, no.
It seems like the definition of halfway around the world. So you worked there, and then you later became a recruiter for the Peace Corps.
I did.
And I'm curious, and this is something that I often see in the nonprofit world, where idealism is sought after as an attribute for looking for talent. But I often find that those kind of stoic grinders can be the better kind of person to include in your organization, because they're less likely to burn out because they have more of a stable core. What were you looking for when you're looking for recruits for the Peace Corps? What were the attributes you were looking for?
So when we were looking for applicants for the Peace Corps, because I had served and because all the recruiters around me had served, we knew that who we were looking for was someone who could work on their own, one who would be able to understand that they were representing the United States abroad, that they would not be micromanaged, that they would be working with people in country who were trying to better themselves, and that it was our opportunity to figure out what we could contribute to advance that cause.
Okay. Did you, when you recruit people, I'm sure you get an array, like what was the common interest? If you describe an interested applicant, what were those people like? Did they have common attributes, the people that came to you seeking it out?
That's an interesting question, because over the years it's changed. The typical applicant would be someone who just graduated college with a 4-year degree. And they had been thinking about Peace Corps for quite some time. And so they were interested in some level of, I'd say, adventure, living abroad, being able to have that opportunity without having to pay out of pocket, because obviously Peace Corps is a public agency. And it, all of your expenses are paid during the 2 years that you're working abroad. And it creates, it has a level of structure, so a semblance of safety. If something goes wrong in country, then you will be evacuated under the State Department. I'd say young person, say 22, 23 years old was typical. And then they would have to navigate through the process, medical, legal, all of that, to be able to be placed abroad. The best candidates are really flexible and understand that they don't choose the country that they're going to serve in. They could, these days, you can choose a particular region that you're interested in. For example, I said I'm interested in Africa, but obviously there are 52, 53 countries in Africa at any given time, and I was open to anywhere. And so I ended up in a Portuguese-speaking country.
Do you think that the Peace Corps has a bigger impact on the community served or the person serving the community? Sometimes you get young volunteers that are still figuring out what it means to contribute. Do you think this is more about developing? If you look at yourself, for example, like, you went to the Peace Corps, and now you've had this long career of different kinds of service. And so maybe those 2 years that you're in the Peace Corps were somewhat effective, but if you actually take the duration of your full career, like getting someone enlisted in altruism as a, like a lifelong career seems like a huge benefit to the world in the aggregate. So do you think it's more about those 2 years or prepping someone for a lifetime of service?
It's definitely an investment. So that frame of mind is interesting, because there will be some people who say, I don't want to take 2 years out of my life. Whereas those who've done it or something similar to that understand that it's an investment into your life. So that mindset is also something that distinguishes people differently. Yeah. And it absolutely served as the foundation of my career. And I think you were asking, did I get more out of it perhaps than the people that I was serving? I think that it actually is, it's a flowing, mutually beneficial experience, because I don't want to undervalue the impression that we actually make on the communities that we serve. I may not have taught somebody something that they didn't already really know, but our relationship together and being able to grow that over 2 years, speaking different languages together, working on projects together, was beneficial for both of us. I think it's particularly beneficial because, at least from the American perspective, is that for an American to be able to experience this kind of work abroad, working with others that they probably would never have met in their lives, that it can be life-changing for them.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about your time in Sao Tome e Principe, plus your time in Mozambique. You had a lot of time in forestry in Africa. What do you think are the biggest differences between the way Africans look at trees versus the way Americans look at trees?
Wow. Okay, that's very broad.
Yeah, let's go to Mozambique. How are trees viewed in Mozambique relative to how trees are viewed here?
So generally, they're fairly revered. There's been problems because of civil war in Mozambique. So the assignment that I served there in 2010 was post-civil war, and I worked with a national park. So that's what's different. Here I work in urban forestry. There I was working with a national park. that was restoring the ecosystem, basically, yeah. there, including large animals. They were importing animals from South Africa, and there's some very interesting National Geographics that profile that. But the forestry component is critical, and the interface with the communities that live within the park zone and right outside the park zone, it was really important to engage them in the education and the ecotourism that was related to that park. So it was a very different kind of project, but I worked with a gentleman named Pedro Magura, and he is, I think he's director of conservation now at the park, and he has a long history in forestry. And he taught me so much about how local people look at trees and understanding that the attitudes towards trees actually comes through education. He said, basically, the most important thing, and as here it's quite different, we say, hey, it's really important to get a college education. There, Mr. Morgoto would say, fourth grade. You go to school to fourth grade and you don't go out and slash and burn your trees. There's something about the process of how people are taught about how to respect their environment, including animals and trees, etc., that allows for it's a inculcation of that appreciation of trees. And so there, trees are part of what is around you, part of where you live, part of the integration and how your day-to-day practices are put into effect, whether you're cooking outside or you're washing at the river, those kinds of things. The environment is part of how you live your life. Whereas here, generally in the United States, and I'm generalizing, of course, it's the day-to-day is quite removed from the environment. The environment can sometimes seem like an impediment to people. It's problematic that a tree needs to be cleaned up after, or that you need to trim a branch, or you need to somehow care for it. Whereas in Africa, it's considered a living thing, a living, breathing thing. And I would liken that to the way that Native American people look at their environment, is to be fully integrated as a human being a component of the environment, as opposed to the dominator of the environment.
Seeing yourself as part of the ecology as opposed to separate, some kind, yes, of like Christian alienation from nature. Or, but it's funny, I do find that like people are perfectly comfortable trimming rose bushes and all sorts, mm-hmm, of things, and see that as just, but when it comes to trees, I think they understand they need to trim them, but it's almost like trees are seen as like these things that should take care of themselves. We'll get, mm-hmm, into trees in a second. I've, mm-hmm, got a few more,
yeah, sure,
background questions. So it seems like in the 2010s, you made a transition from international kind of development to more local work. What do you think, what part of your international development work do you think most carries over to your work locally?
It will always be the inclination that I have to work with the community. So gaining community input. Mm-hmm. It's really critical, no matter where you live and work in the world, if you are trying to get something done, then you need to talk to the people that live there. And so for here in Fresno, for instance, if I want to plant more trees or if I want to advance some sort of cause, then I would like to talk to community groups or talk to church members, just go out and table, get people's opinions, look at the studies that have been done to actually provide public input. To me, that's actually a critical piece of advancing a cause.
You've also worked in some fundraising and like development, raising dollars, which is, it's not the most important part of nonprofit work, but it's probably the most integral, because it just, nothing happens without that. Nonprofits work on how they tell stories, and I'm sure you've had to fashion your approach to that. Have you found that stories continue to be the best persuasion, or we're living in this world where increasing use of data, and so sometimes those raw numbers can become more important than the quote stories we tell. Where do you think we're at in terms of how we procure funds for big projects to help our communities? Are we still in a place where stories are the most important thing you can use, or is there some kind of mixture now as we become a data focused culture?
At present, yeah. It's a mixture.
Yeah.
But data doesn't say anything if there's no story. Yeah. So the why, what does a tree do? You know, all the co-benefits of trees, and how does it affect people? How does it affect, how about this, how it affects the statistics, the data around health, quality of life, health, statistics related to other. So it's the trees tells a story, but it's actually an integration into the data reflects what that means in a simplified form. I think data is more of a simplified form telling a story. So definitely when it comes to funders, they want to see data. They want to see how many trees. They want to see what is the quantification of the lowering of greenhouse gases. What is the acreage covered? Those kinds of things. What's the change in the canopy cover, the percentage? It is actually really hard to actually change that over just a period of a few years.
Yeah.
So this is more the data that's collected for urban forestry is something that will be more useful in 20 years from now to see what has happened, or to look at data that hopefully we have collected 20 years ago. And we can see that. We can see rates of development, how development has impacted the urban forest, et cetera. So
how do you feel about nonprofits using projections? Here's where we will be in 5 years, assuming that all variables stay the same. I see this a lot in pitch decks and presentations. Do you think that's an important persuasive tool, or do you think that's used kind of in a way that's maybe misleading?
I think it's important to have vision. I think having a vision for 5 years is a reasonable thing to do. And I think people want to see it. I think a funder wants to see it. I think the community wants to see it. Like, where are you going? Where's Tree Fresno going? What are we going to do to address the needs of the community? I do typically focus more on the day-to-day because we need to actually perform the work of planting the trees and negotiating the partnerships to care for trees, et cetera. I almost think that it's a separate entity, and this is why I partner so much, to be able to utilize Planet Geo's tree plotter to actually be able to make sure that we're using up-to-date technology to reflect the mapping of where we planted trees so we can track the trees. If we wanted to go there in 10 years, we could find that tree and see what the outcomes are. So it's really important, I think, to merge the actual work of the organization and access at least the minimal amount of data needed to support the work and also to produce to the funders, which is for us is typically the state of California through California Climate Investments.
Got it. Let's talk about trees now more directly. So when you pulled up to my house on my street, there's a lot of trees mm-hmm. at my house on my block. When you're looking at trees, you can use a lot of different lenses. You can use botany, forestry, ecology, arboriculture, mm-hmm. urban forestry. When you just pull up on a block with trees, what lenses are you using to look at them?
For me, I feel it. I feel the difference. I see the beauty. I feel the presence of the trees. I see that it's a community that's taken care of. So and there are trees that are taken care of. So and these are mature trees
and
too.
And you start with right? kind of a holistic mm-hmm. vision.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't compartmentalize or see it through, oh, that tree maybe needs more water, I can see.
I don't.
That maybe comes up. You start with kind of a feeling.
I go with the feeling, and then I might graduate to the species. So making sure that I understand which species have been planted here, what's around us, where there could be more trees, how it's being cared for. But absolutely the first thing that I think of when I pull onto a street that has really nice trees is I look up and I look into the canopy and I see the different shades of green and the way that makes me feel. And I wish it was like that everywhere.
Yeah, there's this movie by Terrence Malick, who's the director. It's called Tree of Life. And there's these beautiful scenes where you're just looking up into these old oak trees in Texas and the camera kind of spins and you get mm-hmm. lost in it. And I find myself doing that all the time. Can you define what an urban canopy is? What is that exactly?
Those are the trees that are present within a delineated environment that is urban. For example, so the city of Fresno looks at the trees which exist in public spaces like parks and any spaces, street trees, those kinds of things, those areas which are controlled. So that for them would be the city of Fresno, and basically that boils down to responsibility. Mm. But a true urban canopy is really the integration of all the trees within that delineated area.
Does the canopy have to be contiguous, or is it just like the sum total of the like shade coverage?
It's the sum total, and the idea is to connect it.
Yeah.
Because there are greater benefits with the connectivity.
And can you talk about those? That was really interesting to read about for
me. Well, it's cooling. Yeah. Primarily, it provides cooling. There's an interaction that tree. There's some of the
trees that talk to each other.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I read
whatever that book is, the Hidden Language of Trees or something.
Yeah, Hidden Life of Trees.
Yeah.
And I feel that. I think that they need each other to thrive. The understanding is under the ground that they communicate and above ground they communicate. But for benefits for human beings, you're creating a cooling effect on the environment. And we need that desperately here in the valley. There's a feel, like a peacefulness, that a feeling of nature that trees provide. And the more consistent canopy that you have, the more peaceful areas of the city you'll experience as well, because there are studies that show that there's a reduction of violence, or it's reflective. Canopy coverage, higher canopy coverage areas typically have less violence. And I think that's associated with heat and stress levels, probably health conditions that people experience, but definitely stress. And then, of course, when we talk about, or at least when I talk about heat and cooling, I'm also talking about air quality. So air quality is just integrated here. It's the overall reason why we are funded to actually plant trees, is to play our part in improving air quality in the region.
Also get on a bike.
Yeah.
Let's say you looked at a number of like satellite maps of cities, and you looked at a map of a city where there's really dense concentrations of tree canopies in some parts of the city. And then you look at other parts of the city and it's basically the surface of Mars. What would that tell you about that city?
It would show you affluence is typically, this is reflective of affluence. It also is reflective.
Can you connect that really close for me? Like connect affluence and trees. Make that really clear, because I think that's important.
There's a value of space that has trees. So when you look to buy a property, it improves
the home value,
absolutely. Yeah. Improves the home value, and in areas that have more tree coverage and actually access to parks, et cetera, it's going to have a higher price tag. So those areas, if you just look at a map from the sky, that's what you're gonna see, is almost every American city has that. And that's the more dense the canopy, that's the more affluent areas, typically the more white.
So this is the concept of tree equity.
Yes, tree equity.
Is there more to it than just that? Or is that kind of the primary idea behind tree equity, is that breaking that tie between affluence and a canopy?
It's also the legacy of disinvestment in communities, typically communities of color.
Yeah.
So historically, our cities have not invested in areas which are predominantly Black and brown people.
Because some people would say, it's just time. Because trees, to get big, it takes time. But then you drive over to North Fresno. Like, I'm thinking of, there's a street, Perrin, that connects you to Shepherd. Mm-hmm. It's got these giant maple trees right along there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, there's communities that are triple the age of that area in this city that don't have any trees.
And that's where disinvestment comes.
Yeah, yeah.
So the investment has been made there. The maintenance and care has been made there. So they've advanced quite quickly in those communities that aren't near as old as what you'd find in Southwest, Southeast Fresno, or Central Fresno. That is why it's important to actually shine the spotlight in these areas like South Central Fresno that need more trees, so trees for the future, and also care for the trees that already exist there. So often it's common practice for taking out trees, especially on city properties, and not putting a tree back in unless it's requested. And really, in my opinion, in Tree Fresno's opinion, when that tree comes out, it needs to come out completely, and there needs to be a plan in place immediately, for at least in coming months, to replant that tree with the right tree in the right place.
I see. So let's imagine you're talking to someone, potential funder or a neighborhood, where you're talking about increasing a tree canopy. Do you start with like individual concerns that are more mundane, like shade and stuff like that? Or do you start with climate and air quality? Like, how do you approach these conversations? Say you're going into a block, and before we start recording, you're talking about encouraging people to invest in their neighborhood by planting trees. Where do you start with them if persuasion is needed?
It definitely is that how do trees make you feel? Yeah. And boy, it's hot here in Fresno, in this area. And do you know the difference that trees can make? It's understanding what it could do for your particular property, where it could shade, what are the best locations to be able to plant a tree on your property so it can shade the house at certain times of day. And then the contributions to air quality. We all know that the air quality is very poor in this region. It actually doesn't matter where you live in Fresno, though it's worse in certain areas, obviously. But we could all agree that we should plant more trees to improve air quality. So I definitely start out, with, frankly, beautification, shade, cooling, how it makes you feel. And then obviously there's all these other great benefits.
It helps with climate change too, and the air quality
exactly.
And all those things.
It's a regional approach.
Yeah.
I've learned a regional approach here. If I was in San Francisco, it'd be different.
Oh yeah, you definitely start with climate change up there.
I talk about that, and that may, we call it our selling point. It is a selling point, but it's not necessary. The great thing about trees is that there's something that we can all agree on. And in this area where sometimes socially, we don't want to be identified as environmentalists, like in the Bay Area, the best way to approach that is, how about let's improve our quality of life?
Yeah.
And quality of life, no matter what income you are, no matter what political ideology you have, people very rarely argue about trees.
I think that's a good broad lesson just in general. Who gives a shit why people do what they do if it's a good thing? Just get them there. If they're going to do something, maybe they don't even believe climate change is a real thing, but they want some shade and the outcome is the thing that benefits everybody. Like, I think we clutch our pearls sometimes with some of this. We feel like we have to use a certain tactic because it's the right way to do things. I don't care. If it gets me the outcome that we're trying to achieve, who cares?
That's absolutely my philosophy on this.
Yeah.
Is that let's talk about the things that we agree with trees. And if you want to have the other conversation about environmental impact and reducing carbon and all of that, we can do that. And as we know, science is not definitive. So it's always changing. It's okay to actually have conversations and to have people that do not agree with the evidence at this particular point in time. It's okay. And they'd still be supportive of planting trees.
Yeah, they're still going to help the environment, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, and we're laughing together when we're planting a tree. It's all right.
Fantastic. All right, we're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated.
Oh.
I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you, and you just tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. Right. I'm going to throw some trees at you, some other stuff at you, just kind of make this fun. We'll start with the most common tree around here, oak trees. Do you think those trees are over or underrated?
I think they're underrated because they're not the most common tree, unless they're the most common tree in your neighborhood.
I'm just thinking about California, native
California?
Trees. Yeah, yeah.
I think that they are not overrated. There are a wide variety of oak trees.
Yeah.
They're deciduous trees, they're evergreen oaks, but the climate is changing. And that, how about this? Yeah. We were just talking about that. It's getting hotter.
How are oak trees doing with
and
this?
And a lot of oak trees are not doing well, or that we've typically, our natives are not doing as well. For example, the valley oak.
Yeah.
There's considerable die-off, and the young ones are not surviving. So we are looking at different species of oaks. We recently planted the Mexican blue oak that is common in Mexico and Southern California in this area to see how it does in our climate today.
Heat tolerant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Next one. Me and Ed's pizza.
Overrated.
Okay, tell me why.
I don't eat a lot of pizza.
Okay. So it wouldn't be your first choice if you did. Okay.
No, it's great pizza, but yeah. I guess just generally pizza is overrated.
Okay. If you had to eat pizza in town, where would you eat pizza?
Oh, goodness. I would probably go, there's like a curry pizza place.
Oh, yeah, that's mm-hmm. really good.
So I enjoy more foods that have a little more flavor.
Yeah, Fresno needs to work on some of that, more flavor.
Oh.
Next one, another tree, a magnolia.
Magnolia, overrated.
Yeah, why?
Yeah, I think it needs more water. So it's like kind of medium to high usage of water. It's pretty, but it's not... It's got those extraordinary blossoms on it.
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of tree dropping from magnolias.
Yeah, those big leaves.
So they're not as useful intentionally planted in an urban environment. Oh. But they can have cultural significance. I learned that in Chinatown, for example, here, that there's significance with the magnolia. I don't know... I think it'd be worth a conversation with the community to see, as we're doing these improvements and infrastructure improvements in that area, if that's the direction we want to go for the future. But I do know that they're planting some there.
Okay. In preparation for this conversation, I listened to the music of Sao Tome e Principe.
Oh, yes.
Do you think the music from those beautiful islands is over or underrated?
It's underrated.
Tell me about your experiences with it.
Oh my gosh.
There's a lot of dancing, isn't there?
There's something called the Funana, which I really enjoyed. Me and my friend Sarah, we loved to enjoy.
What's some comparable music, mentally for people?
So Sao Tome has more of a Caribbean feel than the mainland of Africa. It definitely is a little bit more like a Brazilian feeling as well. So it's warm there. It's humid there. People don't wear as much. You go out dancing. It's a very close kind of dancing. Men and women dance together very closely,
hot and
very fast. And yeah, so it's, and I think the name Funana for dance just tells you. And a lot of people from Sao Tome actually came from the Cape Verde Islands. Because the Portuguese had their influence, obviously, during colonial times. And so there was a transference of people, as we know that history, to Sao Tome. And so there's a sharing of culture between these two sets of islands, both on the west side of Africa, but very long distance away.
Next one, maple trees.
They're underrated. I like maple trees.
You like maples?
But I'm from the Midwest, so
yeah,
I like
they
maples.
They get that beautiful kind of fall color.
Oh yeah.
But I was wondering about coverage. Are they
Chinese maples?
Are they
smaller?
Good?
They're smaller, and they usually require a little bit more water.
Yeah.
So we don't plant them.
Yeah.
Typically, now what we are doing is that we may plant those Japanese maple.
I've got one of those, or two of them.
Near
actually.
Or underneath solar panels.
Oh.
So we're working with OK Produce, which has put in expansive solar along with their charging stations for their big trucks. And we're trying to figure out with their leadership, like how we can maximize planting on their facilities. And in this case, we actually might plant a smaller tree like that. It's a really pretty tree, a place where you can't have a large canopy tree. Mm. So again, it's like right tree, right place.
Yeah, the right tool.
And OK Produce has this interesting thing because they do they have to do cooling for their produce. They actually produce water.
Oh.
So we can offset the extra water that's needed for the Japanese maple through their condensing systems.
Fascinating. Next one's a book. I'm not sure if you've read it, but I'll just ask. It's Richard Powers' The Overstory. Did you read that one?
No, I haven't.
Okay, all right. It's a beautiful, like 500-page novel where all these characters have different relationships with trees.
Uh-huh.
And it's really a love letter to trees in different ways. Anyway, it's
people usually tell me about books related to trees, and I haven't heard that one.
I've read a lot of them. This is in a different tier than a lot of the other ones I've read.
I have a short story about a really great story that I learned when I was at the Partners in Community Forestry conference, and there was a woman they were coming from Australia, and they had set up a system to where all the urban trees, the city's trees, had an ID number, right?
Oh.
So they created this system so that people in the neighborhoods could actually contact the city about the problems they had with the trees. And what they found is that they received love stories about the trees.
That's
They would hear from the community about this tree out in front of my house. They would actually write the tree number. And they'd say, you were there in my time of need. I had a miscarriage and I sat under the tree and I thought about my life. And there was, they were the most amazing stories. She said they expected complaints and complaints. And it turned out the people actually sent love stories to the trees for the most part.
Mm. I mean, interesting? You live life under trees. Like they're much, there's those like that phrase that's used by the kids these days, non-player characters for side characters that are not important to the story. I would say trees are protagonists in a lot of ways. Next one, Ngosa National Park.
Gorongosa. Underrated.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if I was to travel there, what would be the highlights?
That in itself is a great example of restoring a huge, historically popular safari park, natural area, after 20 years of civil war, to where all the large animal species were poached out. As I mentioned before, they actually brought in animal species from South Africa and repopulated the area. But they also have this focus on reforestation and also ecotourism. So there's an American philanthropist who invested and continues to invest in the restoration of Gorongosa National Park, Greg Carr. And he basically made a fortune years ago selling email to companies. So interestingly enough, he took his fortune and basically has invested into Mozambique and Gorongosa National Park over the years. But he has a philosophy of working with the people in the region as well. For example, one of the things that they have done there is that they've taken poachers and they've actually retrained them into eco guards.
Oh, wow.
So it's like a restorative justice sort of approach.
Yeah, you figure out why they're doing what they're doing, which is to have a livelihood and then give them a livelihood that benefits the community. That's incredible.
And then alternative income generation projects, particularly for women, which goes a long way. The investment of women has really shown to pay off for communities and families.
Wow. Okay, a couple more in this section. The trees right in front of my house, Chinese elms. What do you think of those?
They're underrated. I think they're fantastically beautiful. And I think they have the way that the leaves just...
They shimmer.
Yeah, the shimmer. Yeah, I was just shaking my hands that. But you know them when you see them. You see their bark flaking off like that. They're very liked on school campuses. So they don't drop a lot. Yeah. So I think Chinese elm, they're a great large canopy tree. And if you take care of them, they can last 80-100 years.
Wow. Would you rather do a ride at a cycle class or a ride outside?
Oh, that's not fair. Yeah, I love riding outside and I do both.
Okay.
But it's safer indoors.
Yeah.
I worry about people on their phones these days. Unfortunately, I've had friends that
ease into the bike lane a little bit and get a little too close.
And I feel I'm really happy because we have a new member of our Tree Fresno board of directors who's actually an old member, Mark Kepler.
Okay.
I call him the godfather of trails around here for Clovis and Fresno. And he has been driving this need for protected bike lanes, for instance. So anytime something comes up in terms of transportation, you'll see Mark Kepler at the forefront, and he's a big fan of trees. Anywhere you have trees or trails, you want to have trees as well. So if there are more safe lanes and protected lanes for people to ride bikes, then I'd feel more comfortable riding my bike to work again.
Yeah. Olive trees. What do you think?
Underrated.
It seems like they're acclimated to the climate. They don't give you a ton of shade coverage.
They don't, but you're asking for a shade.
I guess I'm not necessarily asking that specifically, but that
I
was
think
just
they're
one.
Beautiful. And obviously they're productive. They make oil for us, and you can use olive oil for a variety of things. I think they're beautiful. They're historic. They can live 1,000 years or more. But I know in this region, in terms of urban canopy and shade, they're not the right tree.
Yeah.
But they can be the right tree in the right space and place. I do prefer them to be used by developers in this area than a redwood or something that's inappropriate for the environment. So I've seen them being used in landscapes.
So that's more of a water question as opposed to a canopy question,
yes.
Which is another dimension of this too. Last one in the section, Chuck Chansey Park as a ballpark.
I love Chuck Chansey Park.
Okay, it's underrated. Why is Chuck Chansey Park cool?
It's a place where the community can come together.
Yeah.
So no matter what team we're associated with there, it's about Fresno, it's about the player development, it's about the community groups that come out to support, about families. There's been tremendous investment over the years by the various groups that have owned the teams there. It's also an investment for the city of Fresno.
What do you think about the criticism that it's too big? That Fresno just needed a ballpark, but maybe that's too big. Because sometimes you go to games there and it can be smart. I think that's probably the heat is a factor there. But what do you think about that criticism of the park?
We probably should have made it smaller.
Okay.
Just a few. There's 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000.
All right. A couple questions to close up just about process. So when you plant trees, maintenance will come at a certain point. Water needed. The city will have to trim trees. And so it is a cost outlay. How do you articulate the cost benefit analysis to a city in terms of planting trees?
So I actually don't articulate that to a city typically, okay, unless we have a general conversation.
How would you then?
What we know, I would work with a business that way. And I would talk to them about, I think it's really beneficial to have state investment, like through the California Climate Investments, into expanding trees within the valley, working with businesses. And one of the reasons why is because the business is very receptive to the investment, the initial investment. But part of my job is for them to understand that they are responsible for keeping the tree alive and maintaining and taking care of that tree into the future. And that is a monetary investment. So that agreement has to be made before there's any sort of investment of state resources, of the public's money, into those facilities. But I will tell you that I personally believe that is one way, a major way for us to advance our urban tree canopy is by working with businesses and allowing them to receive resources as long as they agree to care and maintain the trees into the future, because it benefits everyone.
Okay. How do you think about the difference between encouraging residential tree planting, like on people's property, mm-hmm, versus putting trees along street lines? If you think about HVAC and the grid, having trees on near people's houses is going to keep them cooler, but then they're in charge of the maintenance, and then you can get issues with trees not being well. Mm-hmm. And planting along the roadway, in theory, the city could be involved, but also it's not actually cooling the living space of people. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about that trade-off there?
I think they're both important.
Yeah.
I think that your city, your street trees can actually benefit the house itself, especially as they get larger and provide that larger canopy. So it canopies the road, but it also canopies part of the house. And if you have that contiguous down the street, then that's really great. Trees in people's yards. So for residential programs, like currently we have an Adopt a Tree program, that requires some intensive education, conversation, and input when it comes to the location where the tree will be planted, calling 811, making sure it's okay to dig, and then the maintenance and care of the tree. So this is, if we're lucky and it's a resident that has otherwise other plants and even trees in their yard and they already know what they're doing, that tree is likely to survive.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, the next question was about the challenges of planting trees in an urban context. Is it like...
Water.
It's water, it's PG&E making sure that they're not planting an area where it's going to disrupt part of the house systems. Like, what are the different challenges with that?
I would say PG&E isn't really a limit. If it doesn't clear 811, then we don't plant the tree there.
So
that's okay.
Yeah.
I think we want that.
So that's just
that.
an initial check.
Yes, that's an initial check. The challenges are, I think, water availability, water usage by, say, the homeowner. Even, frankly, in the parks, sometimes in the middle of the summer, they'll turn the water off in the parks, including for the trees. And you can actually understand that for grass, especially when the circumstances are dire. But actually, the state puts out an alert and they say, keep watering your trees, because the trees are the long-term investment. And when we lose trees, it becomes very expensive and we lose part of our canopy. So I would say the challenges are definitely making sure that the trees are getting enough water that it's designated irrigation and not just part of a sprinkler system that's keeping the grass alive. And then I think with residents, it's finding those residents that do have a knowledge of how to keep plants alive. Their trees are more likely to stay alive than an area where it's completely bare of anything. Because we have some properties, obviously, here within the city that are just completely bare and don't have any sort of ground coverage at all. Yeah. And I couldn't imagine that soil is healthy at all.
No.
And we see that in street tree plots, too. We're looking downtown at planting some trees, and I have this lady who owns like a block downtown that they're developing of these really great Fresno-run businesses. And they're taking out some of the pavement in the area where is to be the locations of the street trees. But we're talking about, okay, let's fortify this soil before we actually put in street trees.
Hmm. Outside of tree death, what are variables that would lead you to want to remove a tree? What are the circumstances in which that would be more beneficial than keeping it?
Hmm. Anytime a tree poses an actual threat to human life, or so you don't like you're saying, if a tree is dying, then you should remove the tree, or it at least gradually remove the tree. Removing a tree also can be the case if you planted the wrong tree in the wrong place. A redwood, sequoia, in a small space and on your home plot, and it's actually invading the infrastructure under your house.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, when you do plant the wrong tree like that, then it actually is searching for water and it can uproot and disrupt your entire environment there. So it's just not compatible.
Yeah. So I'm actually dealing with that right now.
It's very sad when that has to happen, but probably the sooner the better.
Yeah.
To remove that tree. And I really hate to say that, but it's the case of wrong tree.
Yeah, we've got a fig tree that was planted like right next to our house line that's already going underneath our house. You need to remove it. And they're so beautiful. But
talk to an arborist.
Yeah.
And that before removing any sort of healthy tree at all. And there are some really great reputable arborists in this town. And we have 4 on our board now. So since I've been at Tree Fresno for 6 years, I made sure that we brought on a number of people who actually know a lot more about trees and about taking care of them and can connect us to companies that are able to do good by the trees.
When you get big trees on your block, sometimes what happens is your sidewalk pops up.
Yeah.
How should we think about that? Is that just the cost of doing business with having big trees, or should the city think about ways to repair that gap?
I think they should repair the sidewalk.
Yeah.
I think we should have wider spaces to plant trees.
Yeah.
I think our planning department, and this is not just the city of Fresno, right? This is just
they
anywhere.
As much street, why not, much street for the cars as you could give them.
Why not give us a lot more space to have the trees be able to grow in a larger space so it doesn't disrupt the hardscape infrastructure?
I mean, you can see it here right around the corner from me in the center of Van Ness between McKinley and Clinton. Like, we have these like big median in the middle where you have these trees that have this big space and there's no issues because they got space. It's a car culture. So
the future is that we can't disregard the fact that we need more space for trees along with our cars. We can have our cars, but we need more space for trees.
Last tree question. How do you think about native versus non-native planting? These Chinese elms are not native to California, but they're great. They do well here. They give us a great canopy. They have some issues because they're not native. How do you think about that decision making?
All trees have issues,
yeah,
including our natives.
Yeah.
There aren't enough natives, especially to our local area, to be able to diversify the palette in the way that we need it, and also to withstand the hardships of an urban environment. So along the roadways,
it's... So is climate alignment more important than whether it's native or non-native?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's why they use climate zones and conditions of soil, et cetera, and the need for the tree itself. So it really is what's in a similar climate in Australia or Arizona, we could also plant here. And we do have that. And we have a lot of success with some of these trees. There's a Afghan pine that we plant sometimes. I think it's an Amandel pine. And I was told that is native to the hills, the dry mountains of Afghanistan. Wow. And it's really tough, and it's really has shown to withstand harsh conditions. And so it's perfect for a long 99.
Yeah.
That's what I was told.
And it's need some survive harsh
and
conditions
it's evergreen
to be long to 99
and,
for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, evergreen. And so it can continue working for us all year round and filter those pollutants.
Wow. I ask every guest how their work informs the way they see a city. So my background is that I work in education. And so I tend to see the city through that lens, see a lot of problems as education problems. How does working with Tree Fresno affect the way Fresno is a city?
I would like to see Fresno to care more about the expansion of the urban tree canopy and to go out of its way to make that effort to have more trees in neighborhoods, especially in neighborhoods that have been formerly disinvested. I don't believe that happens to the extent that it should. I think that we could make real big changes in this town if we actually made it easier to plant trees and to include community members in the process of planting. I think it's great. I love the city of Fresno's Beautify Fresno. Beautify Fresno is one of the best ideas Fresno has ever had. And that's picking up trash, litter abatement, and eliminating graffiti, et cetera. And sometimes we work with Beautify Fresno to plant trees. We need to always be planting trees.
Yeah.
We really do. And we could make a huge difference here if we had more support for the dollars that we bring to the table. Make it easier for us, because there's usually a timeline to spend it. And if we don't have an extraordinary amount of support, then those goals can't be met and the people can't benefit.
Yeah. We always close these conversations with book recommendations. What are a few books that are either important now or, mm-hmm. or in the past that you'd like to share with listeners?
So it's completely different than trees.
Yeah, completely. Oh, no, it doesn't have to. Yeah, it doesn't.
Mine is completely.
Yeah, just give me anything. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
So I have this offbeat hobby of I'm a founding member of the Society of Metabolic Health Practitioners.
Okay.
And it's basically an approach to improving metabolic health through a combination of diet and exercise and whatever else is needed. There's a brilliant doctor named Dr. Chris Palmer out of Harvard. And he wrote a book called Brain Energy. And it talks about the approach to mental health conditions in respect to nutritional application. So nutritional approaches combined with medicinal therapy. And in some cases, they've actually had incredible results with people who are highly schizophrenic, for example, that were basically immune to drugs, but they changed their diet, they lowered their sugar, they stabilized their blood sugar, and boom, things are better.
Wow.
And there's studies that show the same in traumatic brain injury, ADHD, bipolar, etc. So Brain Energy by Christopher Palmer.
That's fantastic. To close, let's say people want to get involved with Tree Fresno. How can they do that? Where do they go to find information? How do they contact you if they are interested in getting involved?
The easiest way to communicate with me, frankly, is through Facebook. So we have an active Facebook page. I think it's reflective of my age. So that's the social media that I use. Lots of pictures on there, lots of information, message, and it comes to me directly.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.